If we place Gog at the end of the millennium, we will not concern ourselves very much with the identification of the names mentioned. The curious are referred to New Bible Commentary out those words to G.H. Lang, Post-Site. Statement in the Scofield Bible, quote, that primary references to the northern European powers, headed up by Prussia, all agree, end of quote, is an excellent example of what's being followed to the thought. Quite apart from the many who have always refused to identify Roche with Russia, there is a strong tendency among moderns, example R.C. Knox, Barclay, ICC, to return to the old Hebrew Masoretic tradition and to translate with the authorized version, revised version, Chief Prince. Well, that's a reference to verse 2. Let me put this up here. I'll look at that in more detail later. But King James says, Chief Prince of Meshach and Tubal. NIV, Chief Prince of Meshach and Tubal. NAS, the Prince of Roche. Meshach and Tubal. New English Bible, Prince of Roche. Meshach and Tubal. Mostly the Chief Prince of Roche of Meshach and Tubal. You see what that comes from in the Hebrew, the Nasi Rosh Malek is Rosh to be taken as prince of Rosh, or is Rosh to be taken as chief, head prince, chief prince? Is it a proper name, Prince of Rosh, or is it a descriptive word of prince? It has to do with how you translate votes. Okay. Translate that as proper noun, votes, or do you translate it as chief? We'll come back to that later. But see, he's saying there's a strong tendency to translate as chief prince rather than prince of Roche. When we find that all the names are of tribes on the fringe of the then-known world, North, Gog and Magog, Meshach, Tubal, Gomer, Beth, Targuma, East Persia, only just beginning to make appearance in the range like those, South, Cush and Put, those are names that occur in this section. It becomes intrinsically most probable that we're dealing with a symbolic use. Revelation 28 confirms this by calling them the nations which are in the four corners of the earth. How then are we to understand the whole prophecy in the light of its New Testament placing? If we accept the conception of a millennium of God's rule on earth when Satan is bound, the curse lifted and saved Israel a center of blessing on earth, what room is there for any such outburst of revolt against God? That's a question that's often asked as an objection to a millennial view. He says the scripture shows us that it always, with all the varying circumstances of ignorance and knowledge, man has set his will against God. The bulk of the Old Testament teaches the failure of the children of Israel, and that is, after all, the gravamen of Ezekiel's message. See especially chapters 16, 20, and 23. The New Testament introduces us to the beginnings of trouble in the church. It makes it clear that they will grow worse rather than better. Here, too, in the mysterious purpose of God, alongside his triumphs in the individual, is at the failure of the organization. The final proof of the failure of man is to be his response when placed in the most favorable position conceivable. Though the sanctuary of God is with man, though the curse is lifted from nature, though the tempter, the enemy of God and man, is bound, yet when the opportunity is offered, the deep-seated rebellion in the hearts of so many at once becomes obvious. I do not know whether we are to understand the name symbolically as those who have kept far from the glory of God centered in Jerusalem, or whether it refers above all to those who in previous dispensations have not been exposed or directly to God's testing. In either case, there is no contradiction between 38:4, where God is pictured as drawing God to his doom, and Revelation 28, where Satan is portrayed as the deceiver of the nations. Man must be put to the test, or else it will not be clear what is in him. Satan is the willing instrument by which the testing is carried out. So I think what Ellison does there is give a rationale that seems to me to be a good one. Or, you might say, this whole philosophy of what is the purpose of the millennial period if it is going to again end in a rebellion. Take a picture. Even though man is under the best conditions until sin is finally destroyed, Satan along with him. And those who are not believers in the Lord are cast into the lake of fire. There's always going to be the potential for rebellion. And this is the final proof of that, so to speak. But in any case, the Ellison then would view 38-39 as descriptive of that which is going to occur subsequent to the millennial period, primarily based on the parallel reference in Revelation 20, verse 7. Now, very popular treatment of this passage today is in Hal Lindsey's book, The Late Great Earth, chapter 5. I know you're familiar with that book. But he sees it as occurring not after the millennium, but prior to the millennium. And you notice on these translations of verse 2, it's interesting, he takes it both ways. He has chief prince of Rhodes. You either have to have chief prince or prince of Rhodes. I mean, it's Nassim Rhodes. Unless you're going to say that Nassim itself means chief prince. But most of the other translations vary between either chief prince or prince of Rhodes, or the Nassim Rhodes. Look at page 55 of the translation. Under Lindsey there in the middle of the page. He says, for centuries, long before the current events could have influenced the interpreter's ideas, men have recognized Ezekiel's prophecy about the northern commander referred to Russia. Dr. John Cumming, writing in 1864, said, this king of the north I conceive to be the autocrat of Russia, that Russia occupies a place, a very momentous place, and the prophetic word has been admitted by almost all the positivists. What's the evidence? Ezekiel describes his northern commander of God, of the land of Magog, the chief prince, the ruler of Rosh, of Meshach and Tubal, Ezekiel 38:2. This gives the ethnic background of this commander and his people. In other words, the prophet gives the family tree of this northern commander so that we can trace the migrations of these tribes to the modern nation as we know. Gog is the symbolic name of the nation's leader, and Magog is his land. He is also the prince of the ancient people who are called Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. Now, page 56. William Gesenius, great Hebrew scholar in the early 19th century, discusses these words in his unsurpassed Hebrew lexicon. Meshach, he says, was founder of the Moski, a barbarous people who dwelt in the Moskian mountains, end of quote. This scholar went on to say the Greek name Moski, derived from the Hebrew name Meshach, is the source of the name for the city of Moscow. Discussing Tubal, he says, Tubal is the son of Rachel, founder of the Kimberani. People dwelling in the Black City, the west coast of Moscow. The same is concluded by saying these people undoubtedly make up the modern Russian people. There's one more name to consider in this line of evidence. It is the Hebrew word Rosh, translated chief, Ezekiel 38:2-3 of the King James, our Bible standard version. The word literally means in Hebrew the top or head of something. According to most scholars, this word is used in the sense of a proper name, not as the descriptive noun, qualifying the word prince. German scholar Dr. Kyle says, after careful grammatical analysis, that it should be translated as proper name, that is Rosh. He says, the Byzantine and Arabic writers are frequently mentioned of people called Rus, and Rus, dwelling in the country of Paris and reckoned among the Scythian tribes.
Dr. Gesenius, Heber Lexicon says, Rosh was a designation for the tribe going north of the Taurus Mountains dwelling in the neighborhood of the Boulder. He concluded that in this name and tribe he had heard the historical phrase of the Rus or Russian nation. So you see, it's quite clear what Lindsay does. He puts it before the millennium and links this prophecy with Russia. And of course, in light of all the post-war situation, the movement of Russia toward the Middle East for the last 150 years, there seems to be a lot of capability, if not force, to interpretation. Notice in that 30 last paragraph, he says the German scholar Kyle, that's his Kyle Dale's commentary, translates Rose as a proper name. And look at page 55, preceding page. I have that paragraph, Kyle. It's interesting what Kyle says, because Lindsay only partially quotes. I don't know if we need to read the whole paragraph, but down towards the end is where it gets to that. But again, God is still further described as the Prince of Rome, Magic, and Jubal. It is true that Ebal follows the ruler of the Targums, the Romans, and next wrote with Nicaea as an appellative in the sense of princess, capital, chief prince. But the argument used for this explanation, namely that there is no people the name of Rome mentioned either in the Old Testament or by Josephus, is very weak one. Whilst on the other hand, the appellative rendering, though possible, no doubt, after the analogy of Maxwell-Hain Road, G3, is by no means probable for the simple reason that Nassi Road occurs again in verse 3 and in chapter 39.1, and such repetitions, circumstantial titles are generally abbreviated. Byzantine and Arabic writers frequently mention people called Road Furious, dwelling in country cars, wrecking among the system tribes. See, that's what he quotes. So there's no reason to question the existence of the people known by the name of Rose. But then, that's where he stops. Notice in this case, even though the attempts of both are to find traces of such a people in Rock Silvani, I claim this name is formed by a combination of both and Milani, is just as doubtful as the conjecture upon the investigation of the frame that the name of the Russians is connected with this Rose. In other words, Kyle does say Rosh can be a designation of a people, but what he says is it's not to be connected with Russia. He says that quite strongly, because the one suggestion is as doubtful as the conjecture that the name of the Russian is connected with Rosh. Now, this Lindsay didn't find it appropriate to hold that part, because that is so strongly against the way in which he is interpreting it. Look at, don't have this on your sheet, but on your bibliography, under the heading Alexander Ezekiel in the Expositor's Bible Commentary, page 122, R.H. Alexander says, some understand Rosh to mean modern Russia, but this identity has no basis. Those holding such a view firmly appeal to etymology based on similar sounds to the hearing between the two terms. But such etymological procedure is not linguistically sound at all. The term Russia is a late 11th century AD term. Russia is a late 11th century AD term. And linguistically, the next Russia with Rosh here seems to have no basis at all. Notice also in your bibliography there, I have two entries under Edwin Yamaguchi. One is from a Jets article, Meshe Kubo and Company, a review article. And the other is a book called Odes from the Northern Frontier, Invading Hordes in the Russian Steppes, 1982, where he has a rather lengthy discussion of these names. But look at the bottom of page 56 under citation. I've taken the material from, first from his Getz article and then later from his book. Meshech and Tubal, see those are two names that occur there verse 2, and I might say that Lindsay connects Tubal with Poblos, the Russian city Poblos, and Meshech with Moscow. So you have words being Russia, Meshech and Tubal, Moscow and Poblos. But notice what Yamauchi says. Meshech and Tubal are the most controversial names in the list of Genesis 10:2 and 1 Chronicles 1:5, the sons of Jacob. If their names had occurred only in these lists, their identification might simply be an accident. But the names recur in the prophetic passages of Ezekiel 27:13, 32:26, 38:2, 39:1. The Hebrew word for chief, Rosh, in Ezekiel 38:2 is transliterated by the Septuagint as proper name, Rosh, giving rise to widespread impression that Russia was appointed. According to customs, it may be observed that Rosh, which in this passage is translated to prince, signifies the inhabitants of the city. From it, the Russians derived their name. Russia was known as Moscovy until the time of Ivan the Terrible, and went out of the connection with Meshech. Much later in history, we use the word Meshech in the form of Muscovy. It is possible that the two famous cities of Moscow and Poblos still preserve the elements of the names Meshech and Tubal. That's the same kind of idea that Lindsay promoted. Now, again, Lindsay's comment is these groundless identifications have unfortunately gained widespread currency in the evangelical world through many channels. The first and second edition is still good reference by them. It's a phenomenally popular book by Hal Lindsay and C.C. Carlton, The Legendary Planet Earth. And the lectures of the Campus Crusade of Angels, Josh McDowell, numerous college campuses. Perpetuation of such identifications based on superficial similarities is completely untenable. In the light of the clear evidence, the cuneiform text, which locates Lucifer, biblical Meshech, and Tubal, biblical Tubal, in central and eastern Anatolia, and Turkey. The Mushti first appear after the collapse of the Hittite Empire in Texas, Tiglath-Pileser I, who encountered 20,000 men in the region of Kutnui on the upper Tigris. Ashurnasirpal received presents from the Mushti, whose capital was at Zaza, classical Caesarea, modern Caesarea, in eastern Anatolia. In 863, Dominique attacked Abel, the region north of the Kish. Tiglath-Pileser sold a stable in 732, did not prevent the Mushti. After the conquest by Cyrus, 506, subsequently the invasion under Darius, remnants of the Muski and of the state, the team and the Greek names, possibly, were included in the 9th satrapy in northeast Anatolia, mostly in the Tiglarenoi. It is a reflection on evangelical scholarship from some of its spokesmen, particularly here, in the groundless identification of Rosh with Russia, and the association of Meshech with Moscow, people with Sobor. When we have had uniform text discussions of him that provided the true clarification of his name since the end of the 19th century, it is true that some of these studies are in French or in works that are not readily accessible or widely familiar, but less excusable and more indicative of a parochial vision is the ignorance of critical commentary on the key Ezekiel passages that provide, if at second hand, the correct interpretation that is included. And then in his book, Prose from the Northern Frontier, he says, though the identification of God and Magog still remains disputed, the identification of Meshech and Tubal has for a long time not been in doubt. All informed reference studies acknowledge the association with Moscow and Poblos is untenable. The names Meshech and Tubal were preserved in Greek by Herodotus as the Muscovy Tabarenoi, tribes who lived in eastern Anatolia. Josephus was also aware of their location in that region. Since the late 19th century, Assyrian texts have been available which locate Mushtu and Tabor in central and eastern Anatolia, respectively. I think you have to be careful about the approach which sees in Ezekiel 38
a prophecy that is presently being anticipated by Russian involvement in the Middle East, which has been a popular sort of interpretation of Ezekiel 38, particularly when it rests on that kind of a basis. Now, this Alexander that I mentioned, who has Ezekiel in his father's Bible commentary, also wrote an article on Ezekiel 38-39 in Jets 1974. This isn't on your... this isn't in your citation. But Alexander sees a double fulfillment. Page 168 in Jets, he says, undoubtedly the reader may be perplexed at this juncture. It most certainly appears that two separate positions have been approved by the writer. He read his whole article. He says that is precisely the proposal of this author. The full description of the events is recorded in Ezekiel. The Apostle John only summarizes his account, both Revelation 19 and 20, since the readers would have been familiar with Ezekiel 38-39. Skipping down a ways. It says, the hermeneutical principle of multiple fulfillment declares that a given prophecy has one meaning applied in two or more ways. There may be a near and far fulfillment, two near fulfillments, or two far fulfillments. The latter is proposed here. Of the two far fulfillments. Ezekiel 38-39 has a multiple fulfillment in one, the demise of the beast, the chief instrument of Satan. In Revelation 19:17-21, and two, the final fall of Satan, the God, the supreme enemy of Israel, makes the final attempt to regain the land of Israel from God's chosen people. The multiple fulfillment is concentrated in two similar events with the last and greatest enemies of Israel, both the beast and Satan, seek to defeat Israel and acquire the land. Both attempts are thwarted by the Lord. The former, in one sense, prefigures the latter. God, therefore, refers both to the beast in Revelation 19 and Satan in Revelation 20. The times of these accounts are between the end of the tribulation and the beginning of the millennium, to the purpose of fulfillment, after the millennium, respectively. So, this is an example. Someone wants out of both ways, before the millennium, after the millennium. His qualification is, the writer is reminded that Ezekiel 38-39 is one of the most difficult texts in Scripture. If the concept of multiple fulfillment is rejected, the only apparent alternative is to declare the Revelation 19 text or the Revelation 20 text as the fulfillment, and affirm the remaining text is only an allusion or analogy to Ezekiel 38-39. Well, I don't want to get into the details of that, but that was R.H. Alexander in the Jets article, which is on the bibliography. He also wrote the Ezekiel commentary in the Expository Bible Commentary, Volume 6. J. Barton Payne sees 38-39 as a millennium, end of the millennium. Let me give you just one other approach, and then we'll conclude with that. And that is one that finds the passage referring neither to a pre- or post-millennial period, but to the intertestament period. And that's D.C.A. Calvert. Again. Let me just read you a little bit in my translation from some sections of his commentary. He says, there is every reason to think on the power of the Seleucids, and more particularly on the rise of Antiochus Epiphanes, when one remembers that the prophecy concerns especially a military debacle, and that by analogy with other prophecies, as for example that of Jeremiah on the enemy out of the north, Jeremiah 4, the 6, 8, and 9. It may refer not exclusively to one single battle, but to a series of successive events. Then here is to be seen a prediction of the battle in which the Jews, under the leading of the Maccabees, within a rather short period of time, brought a defeat on the armies of the Seleucids. That is, under Apollinarius, under Siron at Bethoron, under Gorgias at Emmaus, under Lysias at Bethzur, and later, after the death of Antiochus, under Nicanor, who was killed at Bethoron. It is God himself who smote the weapons out of the hands of God, even though it was by means of the Jews. In 39:3, it says, I will smite thy bow out of thy left hand, and will cause thine arrows to fall out of thy right hand. He says that was God himself, even though it was by means of the Jews. Perhaps there are some elements, here's where it qualifies his view of fulfillment in intertestament time, and particularly with the Maccabees. He says, perhaps there are some elements that look beyond this to an apocalyptic event at the end of the world, especially 38:20-23. Millennial period, but to the intertestament period. And that's D.C.A. Calvary. Yeah. Let me just read you a little bit in my translation from some sections of his commentary. He says, there is every reason to think on the power of the Seleucids, and more particularly on the rise of Antiochus Epiphany. And one remembers that the prophecy concerns especially a military debacle, and that by analogy with other prophecies, as for example that of Jeremiah on the enemy out of the north, Jeremiah 4:6-9, it may refer not exclusively to one single battle, but to a series of successive events. Then here is to be seen a prediction of the battle in which the Jews, under the leading of the Maccabees, within a rather short period of time, brought a defeat on the armies of the Seleucids. That is, under Apollinarius, under Siron at Bethoron, under Gorgias at Emmaus, under Lysias at Bethzur, and later, after the death of Antiochus, under Nicanor, who was killed at Bethoron. It is God himself who smote the weapons out of the hands of God, even though it was by means of the Jews. In 39:3, says, I will smite thy bow out of thy left hand, and will cause thine arrows to fall out of thy right hand. He says that was God himself, even though it was by means of the Jews. Perhaps there are some elements, here's where it qualifies his view of fulfillment in intertestament time, and particularly with the Maccabees. He says, perhaps there are some elements that look beyond this to an apocalyptic event at the end of the world, especially 38:20-23. It must be admitted here there are elements that cannot be sufficiently explained by hyperbolic language. These elements point to the eschatological rise and fall of an anti-God world power. See Revelation 20:8-10. So you see in 38:20-23, where it says, so that the fish of the sea, the fowls of the heavens, the beasts of the field, and all creeping things that creep upon the earth, and all men that are upon the face of the earth, shall shake at my presence, and the mountains shall be thrown down, the steep places shall fall, every wall shall fall to the ground. I will call for a sword against him throughout all my mountains, says the Lord God. Every man's sword shall be against his brother. I will enter into judgment against him with pestilence, with blood. I will rain upon his horde, upon the many peoples that are with him, an overflowing rain, great hailstones, fire and brimstone. Thus will I magnify myself, sanctify myself, and I will be known in the eyes of many nations. They shall know that I am the Lord. He feels, even if you use hyperbolic language, that goes beyond anything you could legitimately relate to the Maccabean period. So he would say that points forward to the eschatological rise of and fall of an anti-God world power. But then he says this should not surprise us. The people of Israel are a type of the church. And Israel's battle with heathen powers is a type of the battle between the church and the world. So you see, he works with type, anti-type, and symbol there in pulling that kind of a sense or meaning from verses 20 to 23. And he says, in the battle with Gog, this comes particularly into view. Antiochus is a type of Antichrist. So, this Seleucid power is seen as a type of the eschatological world power, which will be defeated by the power of God. That's another interesting, and I think it's the only person I've come across with that sort of. Okay, we'll stop here, and that leaves us with Ezekiel 40 to 48.